Hello, I'm Nelson Cole.
And I'm Ivor Luffing.
And this is episode number 2 of Sugar House Journal, the podcast. Talking about the Titanic, or Too Big to Sink.
Yes, the Titanic metaphor has been used endlessly, especially I post a lot on the Peak Oil websites, and I talk to people on the forum about it, and the Titanic metaphor has always been a popular one.
Right, what is the cover of The Onion there a couple years ago said, world's largest metaphor sink. So Titanic has been used pretty much ad nauseum, but what? We're recording this right around the time of the 100th anniversary. It sank April 12th, 1912, right?
Yeah, and here we are at April 12th, 2012. And the metaphor is mostly used for, you know, technical civilization, etc. I mean, you think about it, we kind of feel like we are traveling along in something like the Titanic in a way. I was thinking the most comfortable people just before the Titanic sank were the people who were sitting in the ballroom. You know, they were dancing around and they were getting really good food, and it was probably the most comfortable place just before the boat sank.
Right.
And then the least comfortable place was probably sitting in a lifeboat in the middle of the icy North Atlantic. But who was most likely to live were the people who were in the ice in the lifeboat, as opposed to the people in the ballroom.
And you can apply this metaphor or analogy to today, how?
Well, if you think about it, the middle class of the United States, which is what we are, really, we're sitting here in, you know, the Titanic or the civilization. And, you know, we're kept, you know, we have gasoline and we have food and we have various things and we're kind of comfortable. But we are not going to be the ones that are going to be put on the lifeboats. I mean, during the Titanic disaster, the upper class were the ones that got on the lifeboats. And there were a few men from the upper class that gave up their spot in the lifeboat for women and children. But I'll tell you what, they did not give it up for women and children that were down in steerage. They probably gave it up for some middle class women or children or etc. But the fact is, the people in steerage, it turns out they were not locked under the decks, as in James Cameron's movie. It turns out they were, you know, sort of free to go, but free to go where?
Right.
So they stayed down there and went down with the ship. But then also, the middle class passengers pretty much went down with the ship also, which left just women and children from the upper class, and a bunch of men from the upper class also got in the lifeboats and got away from the boat, and they were the ones that lived. About a third lived, and two-thirds perished. 1,500 people went down with the Titanic, including the entire engineering staff. All of them died because they were trying to keep, they kept the lights on, and they actually kept signaling to other ships right until 3 minutes before the boat sank. And they kept the electricity on, and they kept fire in the boilers to keep things working. And so they really were the heroes of this story, is the people that kept things going right up into the very last minute.
So I wanted to stay with all these, with the wealth disparity, which is getting unprecedented now, or not since the Gilded Age has there been such a gap between rich and poor, that it seems like today that a lot of people are paying themselves really large bonuses and incredible salaries, the CEOs, and it seems like they're just trying to amass as much money as they can, so if the boat starts to sink, that you know they'll have a lifeboat.
Well, they're looting, but the problem with their looting is they're putting it all into their 401ks and their stock accounts and all those various things. But the problem with that is it's an awful lot like there was another ship that sank, full of gold miners and people who had made a lot of money. Ship of Gold, they had a famous book about it.
Right.
And basically all those people stuffed their pockets with gold. And then when the ship went down, they sank much deeper. And so
it's not funny, but it's funny.
It's terrible. But the thing about it is those people maybe, you know, they're beefing up all this paper money so that they can make it through the crash. And, you know, I mean, hey, the poor will inherit the earth because they're going to be the ones that are around. I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, these people are not going to, I mean, okay, they may be able to protect themselves from supposedly what's happening, but it may not be as wonderful a world as they think. They may be able to go off to some safe haven or something, but I think a lot of people are going to go down with the ship.
Well, I like it, though. Which metaphor should we use? The ship of gold or the Titanic? They're both
similar. I mean, look, the Titanic was carrying a lot of gold.
Yeah.
And silver when it went down.
It was packed full of stuff.
Yeah, it had a lot of different things. So, I mean, I think, you know, we're in this place where we have basically what we think of as an unsinkable society. We're all in it. You know, we think, I mean, you know, I talk to my...
You just go around like things are perfectly normal and they'll always be the way in the future that they are now, which is...
Which isn't incredibly insane. I mean, how is it going to... Look, every man, woman, and child in America gets 3 gallons of petroleum delivered to them or used for them.
Every day.
Every day. So you think about it, what are the chances that the world's going to come up with 3 gallons of goo every single day for every person on Earth? I mean, good luck. Forget it. This is not a giant, as Kunstler says, it's not a giant nougat, you know, filled with like a crunchy outside and the center is filled with goo, you know?
Right.
I mean, forget it. You know, so this is just an anomaly. It's a wonderful little time, but the next 20 years is going to be nothing like the last 20.
Right. Well, that's what we here. It's what we're about here at Sugar House Journal: sustainable communities and bridging that gap. That if in the future we have a lot less oil resources and gas and cheap energy, you know, how are you going to survive that change? Which seems to me, in one respect or another, inevitable that we're going to have to go back to some kind of sustainable communities. And
I agree completely.
Well, we're not anti-technology. We're not even anti-business at all. We're pro-small business. We're not Luddites here. My name of my film company is New Pharma Films. Take the best of today's technology that's sustainable and graft it onto 19th century technologies in many respects.
Oh, yeah.
Am I being too optimistic? Why can't you combine those two things?
Oh, no, I think we can. I use the analogy, I mean, as a middle-class person, we're not going to get a spot on the lifeboats. Said the lifeboats are the big money and they figure they can sail off to the Grand Cayman Islands or something and whatever.
Right?
We're not on it. So what we have to do is, while we're standing here, we know what's going on, we have to tie as many deck chairs together and make a raft as possible. And then the place that we're going to float to, if we can possibly get there, is small communities that have little bits of resources. Like our little community here, theoretically, you know, you could live, you know, you could have a little bit of electricity, you could get around in an electric car, you could figure out ways of living around here that are different from the way people live now.
Right, and I should say that we are recording right here at your sugar house in Skowhegan.
Yep.
And you also have an electric car, so you have some kind of tools at your disposal right now to help weather any kind of
coming
change.
A very small electric car. We have something called a neighborhood electric vehicle, which is actually a legal vehicle in the United States. It's most states in the United States allow this. You can only drive it in the 35 mile an hour zone of a town, so it works on an island or in the town limits.
Right. You can't take it out on the interstate, which is fine by me.
But I don't think we're going to be, I think the world of interstates and all that is kind of over pretty soon anyway.
I kind of hope so. If I go to Rockland to visit family, and I'm here in Skowhegan, I have to drive all day long and use a mostly empty car. Why can't I take a bus to Waterville and get on a train to go to Augusta to go to Rockland?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, I was thinking about it. I was thinking,
how is that not the future?
The best place to be is that corridor in Maine, is the corridor from Rockland to Brunswick. And continuing on down to Portland. Because pretty soon, that's going to be a place where you can live without having to spend $8,000 a year for a car. You could get on that train, and it's a nice new train with welded steel rails. It's a great train. And you could go to Rockland, where you can catch ferries and buses on to other places. And you could also live, you could go back toward Portland and Boston and all those places easily. So I think, you know, what's going to happen is people don't realize it right now, but if you're stuck, you know, it's like a cruel game of musical chairs. if you get stuck in a place where the only way you can live is with a vehicle, well, then you better either, you know, mommy and daddy need a vehicle, there's $16,000. So now you're going to have a job that makes at least, what, three or four times that.
Or live in a community that doesn't require so much driving.
Yeah, because I don't think people are going to have jobs and things that are going to give them $16,000 or $18,000 worth of extra
money.
So
here's the thing, though. I mean, the United States is so spread out. I mean, I was once in a class, and the teacher was British, and he asked us to raise our hands how many owned a car. And at least half of us raised our hand, including myself. Mm. And he said, you do that in the same size class in England, you may have a couple people raise their hands. They don't have such a car-centric culture. But then again, that's a small country and it's pretty dense. The United States is so big and spread out. How do we let go of a car culture? Is it possible? Are we all going to drive electric cars, or do we need trains? And if we need trains, we need a government to build them. And right now...
Oh, no, I don't think trains...
Everybody hates government.
Oh, I don't think trains are going to make it. I don't think any of these things. Because I don't think we're going to get it together to do very much more than what we have now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, thank God they managed to fix up the rails there from Rockland to Portland.
Well, we are a company that could defeat Hitler and Tojo in 4 years. And you know, FDR did a lot with the New Deal program. And we have a history of you know, pulling up our bootstraps and doing some pretty radical change. You don't think we can do that in the future?
Oh, I think we can do that. But I'll tell you what, it's not going to be... I mean, I would love it if it was the president and, you know, the people in power telling us what the reality is and how to get ready for it. That'd be great. But I don't think... We're not going to remake this whole place to work in what is coming. Some parts of it will work. You know, parts of it that are already walkable. Places, it's already happening. Places that actually make sense.
It does sound.
They're going to keep. They're going to stay. But other places are going to be... you know, I mean, like right now, the outer suburbs of everywhere are being abandoned. I mean, you know, some of these cul-de-sacs way out there, you know, drive to qualify outside of places in California, different places. Those places are not occupied now. I mean, yeah. I'd say 20, you know, 20 out of every 40 houses are, you know, have been foreclosed on, etc. I mean, so it's already, people have already realized, okay, this doesn't pencil out. There's no, you know, there's no money. I can't make enough money to live out in this place anymore. And, you know, they would maybe underwater with their mortgage, so they just ditch the place.
Right.
So I think what happens, starts to happen is change starts to happen slowly. And if change is already happening, people don't even realize it. They wouldn't even, you know, tell you or whatever. But, you know, the American dream might be, you know, two cars, two-car garage, you know, everybody lives in that house, everybody goes to school or whatever, and everybody goes in opposite directions in their individual cars. But that American dream is pretty much gone for most people already anyway.
Hmm. But you don't think in the future there could be, I mean, we built the interstate highway system pretty rapidly. I mean, there was the Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, the program by FDR's New Deal to electrify the South. Why can't we have these large-scale government infrastructure investments in the future to put trains in a smarter grid everywhere?
Well, the first thing is people won't agree. I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, like right now, the government, I mean, what do you think? They're going to go for anything like that? I don't think so. I mean, look at the, you know, the two parties are always warring and nobody's, like, decided on anything and there's no real money anyway. So I can't see them getting it together to build a train system in America. I mean, unfortunately, it'd be really nice, but right now, I mean, the only real density you can really get is, you know, the East Coast and part of the West Coast.
Right.
And the rest of it, I mean, like, why even connect it all? I mean, you know, there are train networks. I mean, you could certainly run a slow passenger train on some of it.
Right.
But I can't see them putting, you know, it's, you got to remember, all those things were done when we had fairly cheap oil, and we had a lot in America. America was the provider of oil. We had 200 million barrels. No, 200, what am I saying? 200 billion barrels. You know, we had a lot. We had like, we were like Saudi Arabia. Right. But we're down to a tenth of our original endowment right now. We are, you know, we're...
What about natural gas? I mean, this is, I'm sure you've heard a lot of other people argue that there's natural gas, there's coal, there's tar sands, there's oil from Canada, our allies, and Mexico.
We can bake all that stuff up, sure. But even with all that stuff, it's not gonna be enough.
And plus, even if it was, wouldn't that even further the climate problem?
Oh, it's awful. I mean, like the tar sands or something, it's bad. It's the worst.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean we're not going to do it. You know, we're going to keep on fracking gas. We're going to keep on doing all this stuff. But you got to remember that all that stuff is more expensive than what we got this last century. Natural gas just popped out, and it was so cheap that most of it was burned off.
Right.
I mean, it just came off. And then, you know, they decided, oh, okay, let's just tap into this, send it to the cities, and they would electrify the cities or light up cities and things like that.
Right.
That was easy. This stuff now, you have to pump down an evil, viscous mixture, you know, not viscous, but a mixture, pump it down in there and crack everything up, and then you get a quick hit of natural gas with the fracking that then you pull out, and, you know, supposedly they're able to frack all these other places and get other stuff, but, you know, even so, you're just, it's going to be more expensive than just getting it out of the ground.
So really the best way to deal with the future scarcity of resources and everything is to have some small, walkable local communities where you're producing a lot of your own food and electricity and fiber for your clothes or whatever, which is what we're about here at Sugar House Journal.
Yeah, we've got to figure out something and figure it out fairly soon. I mean, I think everybody in America is going to go back to a situation where you grow a little garden, you do a little of, you know, cut some wood to keep your house warm, or you figure something out to keep your house warm. Mm-hmm. You do a little of this, do a little of that, but not every part of your life is going to be cash based. You're just going to do it so that it'll work, you know, whatever it is that works, so that your lifestyle, you know, you can continue to live in a fairly nice way.
Right.
But a lot of it's not going to be cash. It's never going to be seen. It's just stuff you do. We're going to go from being consumers, which we were during the 20th century. I mean, consumers, what do? We just bought things and used stuff.
Right.
You know, we worked for some company that dug it all out of the ground or whatever, to being small-time producers. We're going to have to be very small producers, and we're going to have to, you know, work with our neighbors to try to make this place, make it work, no matter where we are.
Which is, you know, probably a good thing on so many levels, because you live out in suburbia. There's hardly any communities, you know. There's not really a city sometimes. It's just a collection of houses, you know, 20 miles or 50 miles from a bigger city. The kids don't have hardly any sidewalks or any parks sometimes, you know. The neighbors, you don't know your neighbors. You're not really participating in the politics too much. I mean, it's unsustainable in so many levels, and in many respects, how could that not be a good thing for a lot of those things just to shut down?
Oh, I think it will be a good thing. And I think also, I mean, I was looking at it already, and the average person can't afford what's going on now anyway.
Mm.
I mean, they really can't. I mean, you know, you could say, okay, that's a wonderful thing, or it's bad or whatever, but there's no way we're going to start up a housing boom like we had in the, you know, the mid-2000s. There's no way. You couldn't possibly do it. You know, it just isn't there for it. So I think, you know, we are going to have to fall back into these communities. And I was thinking about it, you know, like I live in a community, and, you know, I don't like everybody there. And I think a lot of people are going to do that. They're going to fall back into this little place. And it may not be this utopian community, but it is what it is. It's going to be like a small town that you live in.
But I can't imagine how that would be necessarily worse than what you have now today, where people don't know anything. Yeah. They eat crappy food, and they watch TV all the time. They don't participate really in the politics. You know, they don't get any exercise. I mean, if you have to cut your own wood, you know, you have to take care of your own chickens, which is what I have to do later today, fix my chicken fence.
Yeah.
You collect your own eggs, and you're doing your work in your own garden. That's some good exercise, you know, and it psychologically or even spiritually, you know, it makes you feel better than sit there watching TV all day or, you know.
Yeah, I don't think you'll have to go to the gym so much. You can get all your exercise dealing with your own, you know, things that you need.
Right.
And I think it's going to be good for a lot of things. It'll be much better for the local economy. Because the local economy, like as an example, the town I live in, Skowhegan, up until, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, all the farmers in the town were producing commodities, big commodities that went off far away. They go to a big processing center, if it was milk or, you know, everything would get taken far away.
Right.
Then they get a check back, and then they would use that to do things, right?
Right.
Well, almost, I'd say almost all the new young farmers that have come in are producing small things that are marketed locally. And so the money doesn't ever go, it comes back here and is used and goes around. And, you know, they market things, they trade, they make a living much, much closer to home. So I think that's already happening. I think we're already seeing a time when people are pulling in and figuring out a way to make a living right where they live. And they're reoccupying their
right.
towns.
And it seems like that kind of leads us into the next topic that I kind of wanted to talk about, is that we saw a movie in Rural Square in Waterville called Down East.
Yes.
And that was about an Italian guy came over, now a United States resident apparently, that bought a seafood processing plant. It was a former sardine plant. And can you tell us a little bit about that story? That was interesting on a lot of levels.
Oh yeah, that was the former Stinson Cannery. And they used to be all over the state, but this was the last one. I think it was in Prospect Harbor, down east, Goldsboro.
Yeah, right.
And they were producing, sardines and, small fish steaks. They're putting them in cans. And then when that went down, it was really kind of a problem. But along came this Italian guy, and he tried to start up a lobster cannery. And the lobster cannery would be, cannery, I call it a cannery, but it would be producing meat for, whatever you need lobster.
Right, because a lot of the local people or the fishermen, they would buy the lobsters, but it would be sent to Canada to be processed. And this guy was going to rehire a lot of the sardine workers and process the lobster locally, right?
Yeah, so he wanted to start up one in Down East Maine. Instead of sending everything over to Canada, you could do it right locally. But he had made an agreement with the Baldacci administration, which was a Democratic administration, and before they left, they had agreed to pay a lot of money for rehiring and retraining people. So that would have been, a significant income that he could have counted on. But unfortunately,
Baldacci was the former governor of Maine, Democrat. Now we have LePage, a Republican.
Governor LePage came in, and he said he nixed that. So he lost that money. Plus, he was going to get a redevelopment grant sort of thing, and he was going to use it for different things. And as he said, the redevelopment grant to get people working was $200,000. Well, he put $5 million into this project.
Right.
So the $200,000 wasn't like he was going to abscond with it. From what I could tell, the guy was not living high on the hog. And the other thing is he was employing a bunch of people. So he got this thing going, and it went for, 4 or 5 months. And what happened was, he started sending product out, and all the stores said, the different groups said, we love this product. Thank you so much.
So there was a market for his product.
Yeah, they loved it. But his bank cut him off. And when his bank cut him off, there was nothing he could do. He tried to run it on his own money for a while.
Right.
He took out loans on his house and everything he could. He took out, as much as he could. And still, it drained him dry, and he was out of business.
Yeah, no, wasn't even in business for a year, right?
No.
And this is a documentary made by two local people. Right, just a man and a woman documentary team that maybe in the future we can get them on the show. It was a successful film. There's a lot of angles. There was some, select men that were, that were in the lobster processing business and didn't really want to see this guy succeed anyway, this Italian guy. It's also because he was Italian, and it's kind of an outsider status, so you had a lot of that element going on. You had the bank cutting him off, so you had this international financing factor.
Yep, and
going
I should
on
mention
to a whole bunch of things. It was an interesting film.
Both Nelson and I have also both run businesses down east, and we understand all the various politics and the scene and how you have to sort of make nice with all the people involved to be able to continue to stay in business.
And also, you got that element of a big company who's responsible for a lot of your cash flow. And this guy had a problem, you know, if the bank decides not to finance him, you know, again, or if one big customer decides not to pay him that week, I mean, he's out of business.
Yeah, it fell right in.
And that's the thing. I mean, you got these big companies and you've got the really small companies. You don't have like medium-sized companies, it seems like, anymore. The big bankers, and big companies seem to be controlling all the, calling the shots these days.
Well, that's the thing, is you have to have, if you can either be so small that, okay, the big company says he doesn't want to buy your sandwiches or whatever it is you have, your stuff anymore.
Right.
Lobsters
and stuff.
Your lobsters, it doesn't kill you.
Right.
Because if you you put yourself out there and all of a sudden, boom, it's a big heartache. And, there's no other way to go. You have to decide, I'm going to go, we're going to have enough to give to them, or we can stay small enough so that we sell some to them. But the problem is, this guy had to sell into the world market.
Right.
He had to sell lobster meat, and he has to go big. He had to go big because there's no other way.
Hmm.
You got to get it out there. And he didn't have a marketing thing. Like, if you had a small marketing thing someplace in Maine or New Hampshire or something, then you have that guaranteed thing. He had to produce quality product.
Yeah. It was scary to watch because I wouldn't have gone into that business.
No.
He was a smart guy, and he was really committed to his work, but it's tough.
Yeah.
The food business is tough anyway. Mm. In this economy, it's double tough. And then when you have to depend, you have to do so much expansion, he did, and be so vulnerable to big companies just stopping their cash flow. It was pretty sad. It flamed out pretty quickly. And you'd think, oh, there's a market for it. You should be successful. But not in this economy, not in this financial system that we have.
Well, it eats you up, too. I mean, you can see, okay, you have these huge expenses. It can just eat you really fast, a week or two. Boom, paying out.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, you're done. So I don't know. I'm scared of businesses like that. Maybe I'm a chicken.
Yeah, but
I'm a chicken. But you know what? I think you gotta. If you're gonna make your full time living out of it, you have to have it big enough to do something.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing. Is that government today is not working for the small businessmen like this guy. It's all jerry rigged right now. To bigger companies.
Oh yeah, in a state like Maine, it's all about the big companies. I mean, think about it. They own a lot of our business. Oh, 27.
We got a couple minutes left here. Yeah, try to keep us under 30 minutes.
Yeah, no. I mean, big business is what's always controlled this place, unfortunately. But I do think that there is a little niche. I say little. It's a little niche. You've got to be content with living a small life. And if you could live in that small life, then there is a little niche in Maine still.
Which is the whole niche of the Sugar House Journal podcast. Yeah. Is to help people live in those small communities and be happy doing it. So we've got a couple minutes left. Why don't we talk about what, we're here at the Sugar House, your Sugar House here in Skowhegan. You're on a dirt road.
Yeah.
It was kind of encouraging after all these years when I came down again today. I haven't been here for a few months. Well, at least almost a year probably. It's still a dirt road. They haven't paved it. It's not completely developed yet. So that's kind of encouraging. It's a nice little area.
Yeah, you should have seen this little dirt road about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Was it really muddy?
It was unbelievable. We were walking along here and we saw two cars go right in the middle of the road, get stuck up to their mufflers in the mud. So one we could push out, the other one they had to come with a wrecker and pull it out. I mean, it was like there were so many cars getting lost in here. It was like a mud run. It was wild. I mean, it was like running whitewater. You had to kind of find your way along to find the only way out of this place.
Yeah. It's still very bumpy.
Oh, it's nothing.
With my 1996 Honda, I was a little nervous about coming down. But it's awful pretty out here. I mean, we're surrounded by trees. We're looking out the windows right now. It's a nice area.
It is. It is a nice, it's a very nice scenic area. It's cool. Also, I really feel privileged to be able to do maple sugaring. We've done it for 10 years now. It's kind of a neat thing to do every spring.
And I should say that they can go online to YouTube and see a movie called Sugar House.
The Music of the Sugar Bush.
The Music of the Sugar Bush. Music of the Sugarbush, right? I should know it because it's my film.
Yeah.
You also go to newfarmerfilms.com. I've got a link to it at my website, but that was in the Maine International Film Festival. So it really shows Ivor at the Sugar House. It's a great operation here. Maybe we'll put some pictures up online or on Facebook strictly about the Sugar House.
Yeah, and it's also...
find us on Facebook, too.
Yes, Facebook is called Sugar House Journal on Facebook.
Yeah.
And it's a... one of the Facebook pages. Please like us if you like it, and
we'll put more content up there soon, along with the podcast and hopefully some more TV shows and interviews like that. But keep listening. I guess that's about our 30 minutes today. We're a little bit over. So this is Nelson Cole
and Ivor Luffing,
and we're saying goodbye until the next episode of Sugar House Journal Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.